Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Thursday, April 25th. Your readers are Lori Lee,
Tyra Banks,
Joe Brazel.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by the Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We will begin by reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by the Money, Sports, and Life sections. At 8:30 p.m., our feature program will be Health Issues. And now, Joe will read the TV listings.
Okay, starting on ABC at 8 o'clock, we have the NFL Draft Round 1 running from 8 through 11 o'clock. On CBS, we have Young Sheldon at 8. 8:30 has Ghost. 9 through 10 has Self, So Help Me Todd, and Elspeth from 10 to 11. On Fox, we have Next Level Chef from 8 to 9, Farmer Wants a Wife from 9 to 10, and the WRAL 10 p.m. news on Fox 50 from 10 o'clock through 11. MDC has Law & Order at 8, another Law & Order, but it's SVU from 9 to 10, and another Law & Order from 10 till 11. ION has Chicago PD, three episodes running from 8 to 9, 9 to 10, and 10 through 11. PBS has My Home North Carolina at 8, Creative Obsession Films at 8:30, North Carolina Weekend at 9, 9:30 State of Change, and from 10 o'clock through 11 o'clock, Real South. MNT has Dateline running from 8 to 9, and then another Dateline running from 9 to 10. From 10 to 11, they have Chicago PD. CW has Patty Stranger from 8 to 9. 9 o'clock has Lovers and Liars, and National runs at 10 and 10:30. A&E has Critical Minutes from 8 to 9, Accused Guilty from 9 to 10, and Interrogation Raw running from 10 o'clock p.m. to 11. AMC has The Shawshank Redemption beginning at 8 and running through 11 p.m. BET has Neighbor, episodes of Neighbor at 8 and 8:30, and What Men Want from 9 o'clock through 11 o'clock. Disney has Haley's On It, episodes at 8 and 8:30, Marvel's Moon Girl at 9 o'clock, Miraculous Ladybug from 9:30 to 10, Ladybug and Ladybug running at 10 and 10:30. ESPN is also running the 2024 NFL Draft Round 1, starting at 8 o'clock and running through 11. Nickelodeon has SpongeBob SquarePants at 8 and 8:30, Friends beginning at 9 and at every half hour through 11 o'clock. TNT has NBA basketball, the New York Knicks at the Philadelphia 76ers. That started at 7:30 and runs through 10. And then at 10 o'clock, the Denver Nuggets at the Los Angeles Lakers. And lastly, on USA Today, starting 8 o'clock is the movie London Has Fallen. And then at 10 o'clock begins the movie John Wick. Lori?
Now turning to the front page. And this article is very long, so I am going to only read a portion of it. Shooter Rittenhouse's tour draws outrage. College gun rights events raise questions about free speech and its impact. Kyle Rittenhouse is not a typical college campus speaker. In 2020, at the age of 17, he took an AR-15-style rifle to a Black Lives Matter demonstration and fired it, killing two people and injuring a third. Rittenhouse said he pulled the trigger in self-defense and was acquitted of wrongdoing. He has since penned a book entitled Acquitted and has set out on a series of college speaking events dubbed the Rittenhouse Recap. He is slated to appear Thursday at Clemson University in South Carolina. Rittenhouse is selling books and ostensibly promoting the right to bear arms on campus, but he's also trying to persuade young people to join the conservative movement. The key group behind the appearances, Turning Point USA, is led by the self-described youth director of former President Donald Trump's first campaign and a key ally rallying votes for Trump this year. The group told USA Today that it isn't a nationally organized tour, that its chapters independently requested Rittenhouse. Student chapter leaders told USA Today that Rittenhouse is an important conversation starter. I think sometimes you have to be kind of polarizing to pull a crowd, said Brady Seymour, president of Turning Point USA's chapter at Kent State University in Ohio. The provocative choice of backing the Rittenhouse tour is par for the course for running Turning Point and its local affiliates, which have hosted controversial figures like Nick Fuentes, a white nationalist and Holocaust denier. But it has stirred up devastating pain and disdain in a man he almost killed. He has used every moment to gloat and to make light of taking life, Paul Prettiger said, speaking publicly for the first time about what happened in protest of a Rittenhouse speech last week at Kent State. As if that were not enough, Kyle has embraced and been embraced by those who peddle hateful rhetoric, who believe in nationalism that excludes those who do not look like or think like them, and who have sought to amplify a troubling desire for violence against supposed political, cultural, and religious enemies. Rittenhouse's message on his tour that students should be allowed to take up arms, including defend off these Hamas Palestinian terrorists if they invade dormitories, has sparked protests and raised questions about free speech and just how far it should be allowed to go. A similar question helped lead to the resignations of the presidents of the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard University, who stepped down amid fierce criticism for equivocating when asked if calls for the genocide of Jews would be allowed on campus. Rittenhouse, in a statement provided by spokesperson Gillian Anderson, said his campus appearances are not part of an official tour or book-selling venture, and he is reminding students of their rights. Every American has a constitutional right to bear arms, he said, and it should not be infringed by a college campus. Experts say context matters. Tom Ginsburg, a law professor at the University of Chicago and faculty director of the Forum on Free Inquiry and Expression, told USA Today that federal regulations require colleges and universities to ensure their learning environment is not hostile. Within that framework, some incendiary language could be permitted in a general public space, but prohibited if directed at an individual or group. That's a key distinction, he said. Is it said in general as part of a general demonstration, or is it shouted at a particular group of people who might then reasonably perceive it as being a threat of some kind? And if it's the latter, then it could be punished. On the evening of August 25th, 2020, Rittenhouse brought a rifle to the site of intense protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin, sparked by the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man. Amid a scuffle with protesters, Rittenhouse fatally shot Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber and wounded Prettiger. In a trial that drew national attention in 2021, Rittenhouse said he shot the men in self-defense after Rosenbaum threatened his life and Prettiger pointed a gun at him. Prettiger said he thought Rittenhouse was an active shooter. Critics said Rittenhouse had no right to fire his weapon and was illegally acting as a vigilante militia. The jury acquitted him of all five charges he faced, including intentional homicide. Rittenhouse soon took on celebrity status in right-wing circles where the right to bear arms and use them to defend life and property is sacrosanct. The weekend after his trial, he flew to Florida to visit Trump at Mar-a-Lago and to appear on Fox News for an interview with conservative host Tucker Carlson. At Kent State, Rittenhouse implored students to fight to be allowed to carry guns at school. Other Rittenhouse recap appearances prompted vocal opposition and protest. At Western Kentucky University, protesters held a sit-in and march last month. He appeared at East Tennessee State University in February and also sparked demonstrations. Local news reports show one protester wielding a sign accusing Turning Point of empowering stochastic terrorism, the incitement of violence through public demonstration of a person or group. In the days leading up to Rittenhouse's appearance at the University of Memphis in March, the school fielded a barrage of complaints from students, faculty, and community members. Protesters held signs with messages like, "Put Rittenhouse behind bars, not a podium." Rittenhouse abruptly left the stage after about 30 minutes as protesters shouted him down. Andrew Colvett, a spokesperson for Turning Point USA, said that Turning Point chapters chose Rittenhouse as a speaker. There just happened to be schools that asked for Kyle because he came out with a book and he made himself available, end quote. Ginsburg stressed that colleges and universities must allow free speech. It's pretty clear that their obligation is to make sure that event goes forward and to make sure it's not disrupted, he said. At the same time, peaceful protest also has a long tradition on campus. Ginsburg said an added dimension to their challenges is the more recent phenomenon of campus speakers who intentionally draw negative attention. What we're now seeing is that people are sometimes getting invited to campus who aren't necessarily academics. They're not articulating a truly academic point of view, Ginsburg said. In some cases, we have provocateurs, including some people who actually are seeking to be canceled, seeking to be protested. He said people like Rittenhouse often capitalize on controversy. He's certainly part of a media ecosystem in which you do have some of those kind of characters where if you can get canceled, it ups your follower rate and you can portray yourself as the victim, he said. To the Turning Point leader at Kent State, it's a tactic the group uses to advance conversation. That's the sad reality of how people are, Seymour said. You kind of have to stir up drama or be a polarizing character for people to end up paying attention to you.
Air in America is worse in 25 years. Americans are breathing more toxic air now than in past quarter century, a new report from the American Lung Association says. The findings, released Wednesday, show the worst toxic particle pollution in the 25 years the ALA has released its annual State of the Air report. The spike in pollution, experts say, is likely the result of climate change, including an increase in wildfires. More than 131 million Americans live in areas that showed unhealthy levels of air pollution, the report showed. We're seeing the most days and the very unhealthy or hazardous air quality level due to spikes in particle pollution, Paul Billings, ALA's Senior Vice President of Public Policy, told USA Today. Despite a lot of progress on air pollution cleanup, we're seeing the impacts of climate change, particularly wildfires, overwhelming a lot of cleanup, particularly with respect to these daily spikes of particle pollution. The report looked at fine particulate matter with daily and annual averages and ozone pollution regulated under the Clean Air Act. The report found nearly 2 in 5 Americans live in areas that received a failing grade for at least one air pollution measure. Nearly 44 million people live in areas with failing grades for all air quality measures. The populations living amid the worst air quality are largely people of color who also tend to have higher rates of chronic health problems such as asthma, diabetes, and heart disease, which makes them especially vulnerable to poor air. Together, short-term and constant particle pollution contribute to tens of thousands of deaths a year, the report found. Respiratory ailments, such as asthma attacks, can be triggered by high levels of short-term pollution, but longer-term exposure can increase the risk of heart attack and stroke. The communities with the best air quality included Bangor, Maine, Wilmington, North Carolina, and Honolulu. Except for Honolulu, most of the cities with the best air quality were majority white. The report uses new Environmental Protection Agency rules, finalized in February, for annual fine particulate matter pollution that limits levels from 12 micrograms per cubic meter to 9. Experts said that better reflects health problems associated with this type of pollution. There is no safe level to particle pollution, Dr. Carrie Nadeau, the John Rock Professor of Climate and Population Studies at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, told USA Today. We were not meant to breathe this in as humans. Still, she said, the lower level of allowable particulate matter in the air, even though the limit was reduced by just 3 micrograms, will save lives and health costs. By 2032, it will amount to $46 billion in cost savings and help the U.S. avoid 4,500 premature deaths, 800,000 cases of asthma, and 290,000 lost workdays, an EPA analyst found. Meanwhile, the level of ozone, also known as smog, generally improved across the U.S., the report noted. Ozone is a pollutant driven by warmer temperatures, which climate change has exacerbated. Once in the air, it's hard to remove. Exposure to ozone creates what the ALA describes as sunburn of the lungs. It triggers shortness of breath, coughing, and asthma attacks, and can shorten the lifespan of people who are exposed to it. The western U.S. experienced the bulk of the pollution because of pollution from roadways, agriculture, oil, and gas industries, and seemingly endless wildfires. Communities like California's San Joaquin Valley, along the nation's agricultural heartland, continue to be overrepresented for taking in the worst pollution in the LA report. The cities of Bakersfield, Fresno, and Visalia, hubs for agricultural production, shipping and warehouses where the population is predominantly Latino, make up the top 5 cities in each of the report's measures for 24-hour particle pollution, year-round particle pollution, and ground-level ozone pollution. Gustavo Aguirre, Jr., a Bakersfield resident and associate director of climate and environmental justice at the nonprofit Central California Asthma Collaborative, said the numbers are not new to the community. He likened the air quality findings to reports of the region's record numbers on drunken driving. We would not have a sober day, he said, adding the area hasn't seen clean days in decades. For us, this is just a continuation of bad news. The collaborative, founded to help educate residents with asthma about health risks, has moved to provide updated air filtration systems to homes, as well as community air monitoring networks to give people a better sense of local air quality levels. The organization has also looked at shifting public policy to regulate burn days when old orchards are set afire and electrify big rigs that rely on diesel fuel, a key polluter on the main highways that bring agriculture from the valley to cities in the north and south. The region also faces unique challenges because of its inland location. Pollution from the San Francisco Bay Area and Los Angeles travels to the valley where it becomes trapped. Wildfires throughout California contribute to the problem. Efforts to reduce pollution levels over many years in the region appear not to have saved people in the San Joaquin Valley from particulate matter. A lot of people feel at this point that there's not much they can do to address or change it, said Sarah Sharp, a Fresno resident and the collaborative's deputy executive director. It's just kind of a state where we either have to live or we choose to live. Dr. John Balms, a professor emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, who provided an academic review on the report's health section, acknowledged that there have been improvements in air quality. Ozone levels have declined in some places, but much of the progress has been wiped out by wildfire smoke and related effects of climate change. The same pollutants that affect our health also contribute to climate change, he said. The pollutants increase the risk of cardiovascular problems such as heart failure and arrhythmia, as well as respiratory ailments such as asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Breathing in high levels of particulate matter in the long term has been linked to brain damage that puts people at higher risk of Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and other related dementias. The report only used data from 2020 to 2022. It did not include the impact of the historic wildfires across Canada in 2023 that choked many eastern U.S. cities, turning skies orange. These circumstances were thought to be unique to the West Coast fire seasons. The wildfires in Canada awakened New Yorkers to toxic air quality levels, Black and Latino residents in the South Bronx already knew well. Apartments in the South Bronx sit near several intersecting freeways, power plants, and waste management facilities that create some of the worst air quality in the region. Before the wildfires, the South Bronx had some of the highest asthma rates in the U.S., and now things are worse. Our community is suffocating on a daily basis, said Leslie Vasquez, Clean Air Project organizer for the environmental justice nonprofit South Bronx Unite. When they go home, that air is also breathed in on a daily basis. The group has installed dozens of air monitors across the South Bronx to record pollution levels and the wind, heat, and humidity that contribute to people getting sick from pollutants. Combined heat and humidity, especially during the summer, can trigger additional deaths as temperatures and severe weather increase amid climate change.
Thanks, Tara. Another article from the front page. Billions in foreign aid signed by Biden. After 6 months, the wrinkle of election year politics and the threat of a House leadership coup, Congress has passed a long-awaited $95 billion foreign aid bill that has global implications. The Senate on Tuesday approved the package, which will funnel $60 billion to support Ukraine, $17 billion for Israel, $9 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza and elsewhere, and $8 billion for allies in the Indo-Pacific with a bipartisan 79-18 vote. It also includes legislation that would force TikTok's Chinese parent company to divest from the social media app or face an effective ban in the United States. Unlike in the House, where lawmakers voted for each of the provisions independently, senators had to cast a single vote for or against the provisions combined. President Joe Biden on Tuesday called it critical legislation that is urgently needed and signed it into law on Wednesday. Today, the Senate sends a unifying message to the entire world. America will always defend democracy in its hour of need, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, said on the Senate floor on Tuesday. Tuesday's vote concludes a lengthy debate across both chambers of Congress that reflected shifting attitudes within the GOP about the United States' role in the world, pitting Republican leaders against their own rank-and-file members, and at times the de facto leader of the party, former President Donald Trump. A sizable portion of the Republican conference in both chambers voted against aid to Ukraine, which has been fighting back against Russian invasion since February of 2022. Opponents of additional aid argue the U.S. has already done enough to help Ukraine and that taxpayer funds would be better spent on domestic priorities or paying down the nation's estimated $1.5 trillion budget deficit. Proponents of the foreign aid framed it as an investment that would keep the country out of war, that a victory in Ukraine would prompt Russian President Vladimir Putin to attack European allies that the U.S. has sworn to defend under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They eventually prevailed as Republicans and Democrats in both chambers came together to pass the aid. This is an important day for America and is a very important day for freedom-loving countries around the world, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said on Tuesday, adding that there was difficulty on the Republican side in garnering support for Ukraine, but that things are moving in the right direction. I think we've turned the corner on the isolationist movement, he said. I think we've made some progress, and I think it's going to have to continue because we've got big problems. China, Russia, Iran. You could argue that this is a more challenging time now than it was leading up to World War II. 9 Senate Republicans voted in favor of the legislation despite voting against it when the Senate considered the package in February. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, a Republican from Oklahoma, was one of those who switched his vote. He said he and the group of other conservative senators began working with former President Donald Trump and Republican leadership in both chambers to come up with a package that was more what Republicans could support. Provisions to make around $9.5 billion in aid to Ukraine a loan instead of a grant and to seize Russian foreign assets to fund Ukraine's fight were part of that, he said. Trump posted on Truth Social last week that Ukraine's survival is important to the U.S. despite long-held public skepticism of Ukraine aid. I think Trump had more to do with that than we did, Mullen told reporters Tuesday. The idea that Trump was part of it really helped a lot of people know that, well, it's political and gave political cover to some degree. House Speaker Mike Johnson initially resisted the foreign aid package, but ended up playing a pivotal role in advancing the legislation at the risk of his job. Multiple hard-right lawmakers have threatened to unseat him, as they did with the former Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, for putting a government spending bill to avoid a shutdown for a House floor vote. The threat remains a possibility when the House returns from a week-long recess on Monday. Johnson had opposed additional funding for Ukraine before he was elevated to the speakership after McCarthy's ouster. But after multiple intelligence briefings and meetings with multiple factions of his conference, he emerged in recent weeks with a starkly different perspective. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a life-fire exercise for me, as it is with so many American families, Johnson told reporters Saturday. This is not a game. This is not a joke. Biden first requested the funding in mid-October, just weeks after Hamas invaded Israel and kicked off months of retaliatory strikes in Gaza, calling for the U.S. to stand with its allies. Republicans demanded sweeping border security changes in exchange for their support. A bipartisan working group in the Senate brokered a deal to include what it said were the most significant changes to migration policy in decades. But Trump, en route to capturing the 2024 GOP nomination for president, slammed the proposal as insufficient. Johnson declared the deal would never pass the House, and Senate Republicans voted it down. The Senate passed the foreign aid plan without border provisions in February. When it reached the House, Republicans again demanded border security provisions be attached to the legislation. They refused to advance the foreign aid bill for months as Johnson attempted to push the Senate to take up the House's hard-line border bill. Meanwhile, Johnson kept facing mounting political pressure to act from both Democrats and moderate Republicans. The specter of a backdoor method to force a vote hung over the negotiations, and Johnson was deeply out of alignment with the other three congressional leaders, including McConnell, for whom passing Ukraine aid became part of his legacy. The Biden administration's intelligence briefing and the change to a loan helped cinch the deal. As Republicans dealt with infighting in their conference, Democrats grappled with their own divisions. A group of progressive lawmakers resisted sending additional aid to Israel as the country's war against Hamas killed tens of thousands of Palestinians and created dire humanitarian conditions in the Gaza Strip. Frustration over the administration's approach to Israel reached a boiling point among Democrats when seven aid workers were killed in a strike earlier this month. Calls for conditioning aid to Israel, directing how the aid can be used in enforcing violations of it, grew louder. 37 progressive Democrats in the House voted against the funding for Israel in the House because it did not add conditions, though that represented only about a third of the House Progressive Caucus. I support so much that's in this. We absolutely have to provide Ukraine with aid. I support the humanitarian assistance that's in this. I even support the TikTok provision, Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat from Oregon, told USA Today. But the conditions in Gaza are horrific. I support defensive aid for Israel, but I can't support sending more bombs when the style of warfare in Gaza is producing enormous civilian casualties and the restriction of aid is producing famine. Lori?
Now, one final article before we turn to announcements in the opinion page. Ship that collapsed Key Bridge unseaworthy. The owner and operators of the container ship that toppled the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore last month knowingly allowed an unseaworthy vessel to leave port and are directly responsible for the accident, the city of Baltimore said in a pair of court documents filed this week. The documents were submitted in response to a petition by the Dolly's owner and its management company seeking to limit their financial liability for the May 26th accident. They claimed they were not at fault. But the city said the parties knew the Dolly was unseaworthy because it had experienced a power supply problem hours before it left the port of Baltimore early next morning. early that next morning. Instead of fixing the problem, the city said those responsible for the ship all but ignored it before leaving the port en route for Sri Lanka. Minutes later, the dolly lost power and struck the bridge, causing the bridge's immediate collapse, killing at least six individuals, destroying Baltimore property, and bringing the region's primary economic engine to a grinding halt, the city said in one of its filings. None of this should have happened, the city added. The city's claim referenced an Associated Press report April 15, citing an unidentified source who said alarms had sounded on some of the ship's refrigerated containers before it left port, indicating an inconsistent power supply. Neither the ship's owner, Grace Ocean Private Limited, nor its manager, Synergy Marine Private Limited, should be allowed to limit its liability in the case, the city said, because both had failed to properly train and supervise the crew, failed to follow safe work and operational procedures, and failed to properly maintain equipment and inspect the vessel. The crash was a direct result of the owner and operator's careless negligence, gross negligence, and recklessness, and as a result of the unseaworthiness of the vehicle, the city said. Darrell Wilson, a spokesman for Grace Ocean and Synergy Marine, declined to comment on the allegation, citing pending litigation and government investigations. National Transportation Safety Board and U.S. Coast Guard investigators are still trying to determine the cause of the blackout on the dolly. They have retrieved documents and interviewed the crew as well as others who witnessed or were involved in the crash. The FBI also launched a criminal investigation into the circumstances surrounding the accident, the agency confirmed on April 15, the same day its agents boarded the ship. It could be months, if not years, before the agencies released their findings. The Singapore-based owner and manager of the dolly had filed a joint petition in the U.S. District Court of Maryland this month, claiming the accident was not due to any fault, neglect, or want of care on their part. Although Grace Ocean owns the 985-foot ship, Synergy Marine was responsible for manning and maintaining it and had substantial control over the vessel at all times, according to the petition. Both entities jointly asked the judge to limit their liability for the accident to $43.7 million, the equivalent of the total value of the ship and its freight, minus the cost of repairs and salvage, in accordance with the Limitation of Liability Act of 1851. That law allows a ship's owner to limit its liability to the value of the vessel and its cargo when the losses were the result of a situation beyond its control. As the mayor stated in his announcement last week, the city is pursuing its legal claims against those responsible for the Key Bridge catastrophe to ensure that the city, its residents, and its businesses are adequately compensated for their losses. Sarah Gross, chief of Baltimore's Affirmative Litigation Division, said in a brief statement emailed to USA Today on Thursday. Gross declined to comment further, citing active litigation.
Thanks, Laurie. Whose faith is Supreme Court championing? By Sheila Katz. Your sister, daughter, or best friend is pregnant and excited to be a mom. You fly back to Idaho to help her get ready to give birth, but once you land, you realize something's wrong. She's pale, she's bleeding, and it won't stop. You take her to the emergency room. The hospital can't do anything about it because she's not at risk of immediately dying. So you wait. You watch as her condition worsens, her pain escalates, and you stand powerless as you watch a system that prioritizes a fetus at the expense of your loved one. That looming reality is what's at stake in Idaho versus United States. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on whether a state's near-total abortion ban conflicts with federal requirements for emergency care under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. EMTALA was passed by Congress in 1986 to ensure all patients can access emergency medical care free of discrimination. We have all needed to use the ER at some point in our lives. This case will have real consequences on real lives and jeopardizes our fundamental right to religious freedom. What emergency abortion care means to Jews? Protecting emergency reproductive care that prioritizes the life of the pregnant person is at its very core about our right to religious freedom in a country that claims to have separation of church and state. People of all faiths must be able to practice what their religion teaches. For Jews, our values and texts compel us to always prioritize and safeguard the well-being of the pregnant person if their life is at stake. This is widely agreed upon among Jews in the United States, 83% of whom believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, all major Jewish denominations issued statements sharing concern for our religious freedom, with particular consensus around cases where the life of the pregnant person is at risk. A question emerges, indicating the severe implications around the outcome of this Supreme Court case for Jews, atheists, and all minority religions. Must we die in order to preserve one Christian understanding of life? Over the past 2 years, laws designed by Christian religious extremists, rooted in just one narrow interpretation of when life begins, have led to dire consequences for people who don't want to be pregnant, and for those who do but face medical complications. The motivation behind these laws does not get talked about enough and should raise serious flags for all who uphold that the United States is a beacon of religious freedom. The reality is Christian extremists manipulate our democratic system to preserve Christian theocracy. We saw that in the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization ruling, when we later learned that some justices are reported to have prayed with the anti-abortion evangelicals they cited about morality in the majority opinion. We saw that when we looked into the funders behind both the Dobbs decision and the case to ban abortion medication and realized they are the same people who put out the "He Gets Us, Jesus" ads during the Super Bowl broadcast. Whether on the screen or in our laws, Christian extremists are pulling all levers to advance their moral agenda. There is no morality in denying women the life-saving emergency medical care they need. And when it comes to abortion, both those of faith and those of no faith support access. Exodus 21:22-23 recounts a story of two fighting men who injure a pregnant woman, resulting in her subsequent miscarriage. The common rabbinical conclusion of this verse is that the men did not commit murder because the fetus is not a person. Instead, the primary concern is the well-being of the person who is injured. This text has led to the understanding that Judaism values protecting the life of the mother at all stages of pregnancy. This sanctity is core to our religious freedom. Ironically, the Supreme Court's oral arguments for this Idaho case fell during the holy days of Passover, a time when we honor the liberation of Jews. During this time, we also traditionally abstain from working and traveling. Many Jews who would normally go to the Supreme Court to hear oral arguments or to engage with this case as it's happening weren't able to do so. Many faiths make up the United States. The irony and pain of an important case deciding our religious freedom being scheduled on a sacred day for Jews further hits at the fundamental idea that our nation is rooted in Christian theocracy, despite the many faiths that make up the United States. It's time to speak up. A small but loud group of Christian extremists dominate the narrative around abortion and religion. Religious freedom is meant to be a shield to protect and never a sword to discriminate. But in courts and state legislatures across the country, they have continually slashed our freedoms and our rights. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act is one of the last remaining threads of federal reproductive care, and Christian extremists are threatening to destroy it. When they went before the Supreme Court on Wednesday, once again using religious freedom as an excuse to deny emergency care to pregnant women in desperate circumstances, we need to ask, whose faith are they championing? I know it's not mine. Sheila Katz is the CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women, a 130-year-old Jewish feminist civil rights organization with more than 210,000 advocates and 49 local sections across the United States.
Okay, our other opinionated article is from Dace Potas, who's an opinion fellow for USA Today. He's a graduate from DePaul University with a degree in political science. He's also president of the Lone Conservative, the largest conservative student-run publication in the country. And it's entitled, Republicans Decide If You're Anti-Abortion or Just Pro-Vote. Donald Trump has a long history of flip-flopping on the issue of abortion when it suits his needs. He was at it again when he told reporters recently that he would not sign a federal abortion ban if he became president again, and if it came to his desk, even if Congress managed to pass such a monumental piece of legislation. Trump's latest comments are different from those he made as president when he vowed to veto any legislation that weakens pro-life policies or that encourages the destruction of human life. He also affirmed just last year that there remains a vital role for the federal government in protecting unborn life. When he ran for president in 2016 and desperately needed the evangelical vote to win, he emerged as staunchly anti-abortion. Now he has softened his view on this issue to save some face among moderate voters, and he's not the only one. He said all those things after saying he was very pro-choice during a 1999 NBC News interview. I believe people can change their minds on complex issues like abortion. I would have at one point referred to myself as anti-abortion, a position I disagree with now. But Republicans have for years wanted abortion to be illegal. It has been a conservative rallying cry for generations. So why now are Republican lawmakers trying to seem so much more moderate? Is it because, like Trump, they only care about being reelected? When the Supreme Court correctly overturned the precedent set by Roe v. Wade in 2022, many in the anti-abortion movement, including myself, viewed that decision as vital and needed in the progress of protecting life. At the time, I knew that abortion re-entering the political arena would pose significant challenges for Republicans. However, what I overlooked was the possibility that the decision would ultimately make Republicans less anti-abortion. If Republicans truly want to remain the anti-abortion party, they can't follow Trump's lead on the issue. Sadly, it seems that some are doing just that. Carrie Lake, an Arizona Republican Senate candidate, has denounced the state's enforcement of a 160-year-old near-total abortion ban by calling the law out of line despite once referring to it as a great law. You'll remember she is a huge Trump supporter who lost her bid for the Arizona governor's chair. She went even further over recently, releasing a new ad on her abortion position. Abortion is such a personal and private issue. I chose life, but I'm not every woman, Lake said. Her position sounds more like a religious Democrat than that of a serious anti-abortion candidate. Nikki Haley, Trump's former opposition for the Republican presidential nomination, also tried to lean into the more moderate rhetoric on the issue. As much as I'm pro-life, I don't judge anyone for being pro-choice, and I don't want them to judge me for being pro-life, Haley said on the campaign trail. Let's find consensus. We don't need to divide America over this issue anymore. Senator Steve Daines, a Republican from Montana, joined the more moderate messaging on abortion after the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision sent the issue back to the states. Republicans do not support a federal ban on abortion, period, said Daines, who once co-sponsored a federal 15-week ban. Republicans seem to have been scared out of their principles since Roe was overturned 2 years ago. Sure, messaging on the issue could adjust in light of public sentiment, and I think Haley's approach of honesty on the issue is far closer to the correct one than Trump's. After all, no civil rights movement ever became accomplished in one fell swoop. Incremental change is the bedrock of any movement's potential to achieve something significant in this country. However, the anti-abortion movement cannot cede ground on the ultimate endpoint of the issue, which is protecting life through all stages. Trump and other Republicans are actively giving in to the opposition, which is the first step in losing the battle. The goalposts are shifting from eventual protection of life at all stages to the protection of life only some of the time. If we want to make progress on protecting life, we must stay committed no matter how difficult it is to convince those who disagree with us. We cannot be willing to meet in the middle on an issue as significant as protecting human life. We need to be vocal about our beliefs to Trump and other Republicans who are willing to push us to the back when we've become inconvenient for them. Our vote must be earned. And now I'll hand it over to the announcements. To myself, you are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering information and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned sub-channel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website, ncreadingservice.org. You can listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the right upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you're using an assisted technology device such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, "Tune in NC Reading Service" to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following their initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on the Listen tab, and then click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Tactile tours available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision, these docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are by request only and must be scheduled at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please call 919-664-6854 or email accessibility coordinator Molly Hull at mhull, that's H-U-L-L, at ncartmuseum.org. Accessible Pharmacy Blindness and Mental Health Summit. Accessible Pharmacy, a provider of home-delivered prescription medicines with talking bottles, is hosting the first annual Blindness and Mental Health Summit. This virtual and free summit is the largest online gathering of organizations and consumers sharing information, resources, and services focusing on mental health in the blindness, low vision, and disability communities. The Blindness and Mental Health Summit will be held online Friday, June 14th from noon until 4 p.m. For more information or to register for this free online event, visit the Accessible Pharmacy website at accessiblepharmacy.com. You will find the Blindness and Mental Health Summit under the Events tab. And lastly, get active and get outdoors. The North Carolina Assisted Technology Program has been hosting pop-up fairs at various locations throughout the state. Learn about local resources and get hands-on experience with accessible equipment regardless of your ability at an adaptive recreation and active learning resource fair. Fairs are free and open to the public. We encourage everyone interested in staying active, accessible recreation, and leisure activities to attend. A pop-up fair will be at the following locations, and the one is next Friday, May 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Charlotte Center in Charlotte. The events are free, but registration is required. To register or to learn more about the NCATP Center nearest you, visit their website at www.ncdhhs.gov/NCATP.
And now turning to the money section. Costs of child care keep increasing, report finds. A new report says American families that pay for child care spend nearly one-fifth of their income on the service, and costs are rising. The average household with child care bills spends $325 a week, or 18.6% of its weekly income, according to an analysis by LendingTree. In Nevada, the costliest child care state, families spend 32.3% of their income, an average of $493 a week, for others to tend their children, the report says. LendingTree released the analysis last month, drawing on census data. Child care expenses eat up more than one-fifth of parental income in eight other states, including Illinois, Louisiana, and Texas, the report found. Child care costs pushed Morgan Fry out of her Sparks, Nevada home. Fry, 31, was paying $245 a week on child care for her son, who is now five. That was half of her take-home pay from her job as a caregiver to seniors. In February 2023, poverty forced her and her son into a homeless shelter. It was really hard, she said, and honestly, the decision to keep him in school came down to knowing it was best for him. It felt like a necessity. Relief arrived the next month. The Children's Cabinet, a Nevada nonprofit, swept in to pick up Fry's child care costs. In June of 2023, she and her son moved into a new home. I have enough money to put gas in the car, food on the table, she said. Only now does Fry realize how stressed out she had become over child care bills. I am able to be a more present parent, she said. We play catch, we go outside, we do things. Several economic factors have pushed up costs and stretched supply in the child care industry, experts say. One is inflation, which has raised prices in the last few years. Another is the pandemic, which shuttered thousands of child care centers. A third is the expiration of pandemic-era federal funding for child care centers last fall, a cutback observers likened to a child care cliff. There's so much that goes into proper child care, whether it's wages or rent or insurance or 500 other things, said Matt Schultz, chief credit analyst at LendingTree. When the cost of everything is rising, it makes all the sense in the world that the cost of child care would too. Nevada, the costliest child care state, exemplifies the national problem and caregiving challenges particular to the state. Child care options in Nevada are spread thin because of population growth, a scarcity of providers, and a hospitality industry whose workers need child care at all hours. Along with being in the actual desert, it's full of what they call child care deserts, where there's simply not enough supply for all the demand that's out there, Schultz said of Nevada. It stands to reason that any place that's grown so fast would have some issues with keeping up with demand. The LendingTree analysis shows that the average child care client in Nevada paid roughly one-third of the $1,526 average weekly family income in the state. New Jersey ranks second among the states in child care costs at $442 a week, but that sum reflects only 19% of the average weekly family income in the Garden State, which is $2,325. Where is the cheapest child care? That's Iowa, with an average weekly cost of $182 or 10.1% of the state's average weekly family income. Other recent reports sound a similar alarm on the spiraling costs of child care. The 2024 cost of care report from the caregiver site care.com found that the average family spends 24% of household income on child care. The report draws from a November survey of 2,000 adults. According to the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, affordable child care means spending no more than 7% of household income on the service. It certainly is the case that child care costs have gone up faster than inflation, said Elise Gould, a senior policy analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, a nonpartisan left-leaning think tank that has also studied child care costs in depth. What we discovered a few years ago is that child care is more expensive than rent for quite a few families, and that is pretty shocking. The crippling costs of child care force many parents, and especially mothers, into a difficult choice between care and career. According to the Casey Foundation report, 13% of children 5 and under lived in families in which someone quit a job, changed jobs, or refused a job because of child care conflicts. Women are several times more likely than men to suffer negative consequences than their employment from caregiving duties, the report said. No parent should be forced to choose between their family and their work, which unfortunately happens all too often. Mothers often leave the job market rather than spend much of their salary on child care, financial experts said. That choice can unravel their lifetime career prospects. Sometimes it feels like you're working just to pay for that child care, said Catherine Villega, a certified financial planner in Boston. Nonetheless, Villega urges her female clients to remain in the workforce. "I'm just a big believer in staying in the market," she said. "I think it's important to keep up your skills, but I also think it's important for your own mental health." And for more tips on, go to care.com, which offers tips for parents to manage child care costs.
Thanks, Laurie. Our next money article, airlines to be upfront about prices and refunds. The Department of Transportation announced new rules on Wednesday to better protect airline passengers against costly surprise airline fees, the agency said. As part of the Biden-Harris administration's efforts to crack down on corporate ripoffs, two new air travel rules were finalized. The rules mandate airlines to pay full refunds in a timely and straightforward manner and ensure transparency regarding fees associated with air travel. The new regulations are expected to save consumers over $500 million each year in hidden junk fees, the DOT said. Passengers deserve to know up front what costs they are facing and should get their money back when an airline owes them without having to ask, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg said in a statement. Today's announcements will require airlines to both provide passengers better information about costs before ticket purchase and promptly provide cash refunds to passengers when they are owed, not only saving passengers time and money, but also preventing headaches. What to know about the newly finalized rules for airline passengers? What are new rules from DOT, and how do they impact passengers? Well, the first new regulation will simplify the process for airline passengers to get what they're owed by requiring airlines to give automatic cash refunds. Passengers can get these refunds when their flights are canceled or significantly changed, their checked bags are significantly delayed, or the ancillary services like Wi-Fi they purchased are not provided, the announcement said. The second will require airlines and ticket agents to be upfront about any hidden fees, such as checking a bag or changing a flight, to help consumers avoid unneeded or expected charges that can quickly increase and add significant costs to what may, at first, look like a cheap ticket. Airline fees, increasingly common for airlines to boost their profit, have grown confusing for passengers. Both rules will go into effect in about 6 months or around the end of October, the agency said. How will new rules make getting refunds from airlines easier? Getting a refund from airlines is a long-winded and often complicated process. Sometimes passengers end up getting a travel credit or voucher instead of an actual reimbursement or just a partial refund. Under the new regulation, refunds will be much more straightforward. Airlines must promptly provide automatic refunds without passengers explicitly requesting them, and the refunds must be issued in the original payment method used to make the purchase. How fast will the refund get to me? Airlines will have 7 business days to make full refunds for credit card purchases and 20 calendar days for other payment methods. How else is the DOT cracking down on hidden airline junk fees? It can be tricky to know exactly how much your final airline ticket will cost due to hidden fees. What may look like a low price at first can quickly add up. Airlines will now have to disclose any baggage, change in cancellation fees and policies before purchases are made, and it has to be clear and upfront, not hidden behind a hyperlink. Airlines will also need to be transparent about weight and dimension limitations. Third-party websites such as Expedia or Booking.com will also be required to display this information. These days, it's common for people to pay for seat selection, especially for the lowest price fares, but carriers will now need to inform consumers that seats are guaranteed and it's unnecessary to pay for one. The DOT is also banning airlines from using bait-and-switch tactics, in which an airline advertises a discounted fare that doesn't include mandatory fees that drive the ticket price up.
Moving on to sports, we've got our first article about tonight's draft. NFL draft in Detroit is largely huge, historic. The NFL draft is in Detroit this week, and I don't think people fully understand the importance of this moment, what it means historically and racially. Let me explain. In the book When the Lions Were Kings, The Detroit Lions in the Fabulous 50s, author Richard Bach wrote about the 1950s Detroit as follows. Although Detroit's black population would pass 400,000 during the 1950s, until late in the decade, there was no black representation on city council, there were no blacks playing for the Detroit Tigers, and policemen patrolled the streets in segregated squad cars. Detroit was the home of the modern labor movement, and the membership of the United Auto Workers was one quarter black, yet there still wasn't a single minority on the UAW's executive board. When a local firebrand named Coleman Young Jr. visited the offices of the Detroit News, every reporter, editor, printer, and secretary encountered was white. I did stumble upon a couple of black men mopping the floor in the lobby, the future mayor recalled in his autobiography, and when I asked how many blacks worked in the building, they said, "You're looking at them." Bach also wrote, intentionally or not, during the 1950s, the Lions were a microcosm of the segregated Motor City. Between 1950 and 1957, there never was more than one black on the roster at any given time. For most of that period, there were none. During a six-season stretch from 1951 through 1956, the Lions fielded just two black players, defensive lineman Harold Turner and Walter Jenkins. Walter Jenkins, who appeared in a total of five regular season games between the two of them. Bill Matney, Russ Cowens, and other members of the black press considered the Lions a historically racist organization. Just how far that characterization was remains open to debate. It was true that the championship squads of 1952 and 1953 didn't have a single black face in the huddle. There was also just one black player on the 1957 championship team. His name was John Henry Johnson, and he'd be later inducted into the Hall of Fame. Of course, none of this is utterly shocking. The disgrace of segregation happened in many American cities. This country has long been soaked in hatred, and in some ways still is. It's nonetheless remarkable to look back at how far we've come. The Lions also have a unique place in history because of one remarkable fact. Bach writes that the two championship teams in 52 and 1953 didn't have a black player on them, making the Lions the last team to win an NFL title with an all-white roster. Over the 70 years later, look at Detroit now. The city, the Lions, and the NFL draft are so remarkably different. There was a black mayor. The Tigers are integrated. There have been two black presidents of the UAW. The Detroit News is no longer all white. The police are no longer segregated. Now the best player in Lions history, Barry Sanders, is black. Receiver Amon-Ra St. Brown, whose father named his children with African and Egyptian names, is immensely popular and is black. The team's general manager, Brad Holmes, is black. Many of the players are. Overall, the second most important element of the NFL calendar is the draft, and it's in Detroit. The top overall draft pick is expected to be Southern Cal's Caleb Williams, who is black. The city, the team, the league, the draft all mostly shun black people in the past. Each of those entities is super duper black. Yes, definitely we've come a long way. We've traversed the length of several galaxies. It took three quarters of a century to reach this point. There are still disgusting things said about the city and some of the people that inhabit it, but the city has a glow that no one can take away. It started after the team got its first playoff victory in 32 years by beating the Los Angeles Rams this past season. The city, the Lions, the draft, so much has changed for the better. Lori?
NBA legend Gary Payton out as Lincoln U coach. Gary Payton is out as the head men's basketball coach at Lincoln University after an unusual and at times contentious stint at the little-known school in Oakland, California. Lincoln University did not disclose the nature of Payton's departure, but it announced the hiring of William Middlebrooks, who previously coached high school basketball in California, as its head coach this month. The coaching change came roughly 3 months after Payton had made highly critical remarks about Lincoln and its athletic program during an interview with USA Today Sports. Peyton's criticism mirrored much of what many former and current football players told USA Today Sports for a story about the school's struggling football program, in which one former player dubbed the school the College Bishop Sycamore. Peyton, who had not been paid the past two seasons and was working as a volunteer, did not respond to requests for comment, left with his agent and his former top assistant coach at Lincoln. Middlebrooks referred questions to the school, and university president Brodsky largely deferred questions about Peyton to athletic director Desmond Gumbs, who did not immediately reply to an email. Brodsky, however, did say that Gumbs told him Lincoln's new coach would have to rebuild the program. He added that Peyton's insistence on taking 19 people on the road for away games was too costly. "I respect him a lot, but it doesn't mean he can work here," Brodsky said. Peyton's departure comes after three seasons at Lincoln, which is not affiliated with the NCAA or any other National College Athletic Association. He was hired when the school decided to start an athletic program in 2021. Peyton, a nine-time NBA All-Star who was inducted into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame in 2013, told USA Today Sports in an interview in early January that he took the job at Lincoln for a chance to work with players in his hometown of Oakland. "I'm here for these kids, basically," he told USA Today Sports. "That's about it. It's nothing else." Over time, however, Peyton said he had grown incredibly frustrated with the school and its leadership for several reasons, including that Lincoln had stopped paying his assistant coaches. He also said insufficient funds for travel forced him to cancel three trips, and he had to pay for the players' uniforms, shoes, and meals on the road. "I've stuck around too long," he said. "We should have been better than this." Brodsky took issue with Peyton's criticism of the school. "He's spending money like crazy," Lincoln's president said in early January, noting that the basketball team's travel party has included 12 players and 7 staff members. Peyton had not collected a salary from the school for at least 18 months. Lincoln's most recently available tax records show that he made $112,500 during the 2021 calendar year. Ed Brodsky emailed that Peyton was paid an additional $90,000 in the early part of 22, before the university stopped paying him due to a lack of funds. During the 2023-2024 season, Peyton guided the Oaklanders to the regular season championship in the Southwestern States Intercollegiate Conference and also won the conference's postseason tournament. But during the spring semester, none of the players were registered for classes, according to Brodsky. He said the players provided no reason for not registering, did not request a leave of absence, and would not be allowed to return to school. Brodsky didn't explain why the team members were allowed to play despite not being registered, which is prohibited by major college governing bodies.
Next, we have Reggie Bush getting 05 Heisman Trophy back. Reggie Bush is getting his Heisman Trophy back. ESPN reported Wednesday that the Heisman Trust, which administers the annual award for college football's most outstanding player, is set to announce that his trophy from the 2005 season will be officially reinstated and returned to him, given the fundamental changes in college athletics, including the ability for college athletes to now profit off their name, image, and likeness. Bush was at the center of a pay-for-play scandal during his time at Southern Cal, which led to massive NCAA penalties for the school and forfeiture of the trophy. According to ESPN, Bush will immediately be invited to the annual Heisman Trophy ceremony, as all former winners are. "We are thrilled to welcome Reggie Bush back to the Heisman family in recognition of his collegiate accomplishments," says Michael Comerford, president of the Heisman Trust, told ESPN. "We considered the enormous changes in college athletics over the last several years in deciding that now is the right time to reinstate the trophy for Reggie. We are so happy to welcome him back." Bush was the overwhelming winner of the 2005 Heisman, receiving 784 of the 892 first place votes after a season in which he ran for 1,740 yards on 200 attempts. In the fall of 2006, after he had been drafted by the New Orleans Saints as the number two pick, Yahoo Sports reported that Bush and his family had received benefits worth more than $100,000 from agents while enrolled at USC, which was against NCAA rules at the time. The benefits included weekly payments and a year of rent-free living at the California home of Michaels, who was trying to start a marketing agency with Bush as his primary client. Because Bush was ruled ineligible, USC was ordered to disassociate from the running back, ban him from campus, and expunge all his records. Shortly thereafter, the Heisman Trust revoked the award for the first time in its history. Personally, I'm thrilled to reunite with my fellow Heisman winners and be part of the storied legacy of the Heisman Trophy, and I'm honored to return to the Heisman family, Bush said in a statement to ESPN.
And now turning to the life section. Reynolds McElhaney, talk. Welcome to Wrexham. I don't know that I've ever felt a sense of relief like that, says Reynolds. We're carrying with us the hopes and dreams of so many people. It felt like a dam breaking. It was as if something left our bodies, adds McElhaney. That whistle marked an end and a beginning for Wrexham, and it's the perfect plot point for season three of Welcome to Wrexham. Wrexham, FX's docu-series that runs May 2nd that's Thursdays at 10 o'clock, and streaming next day on Hulu. So it returns May 2nd at 10, and then on FX, and then begins streaming the following day on Hulu. In 2020, Reynolds and McElhaney bought Wrexham AFC. The Welsh team, founded in 1864, is the third oldest professional soccer club in the world, but it had been exiled to the National League, the fifth tier of English football, for over a decade. When the $2.5 million purchase was finalized in 2021, it looked like the actors had invested in a fixer-upper, the sports equivalent of an HGTV renovation show. It's apparent now that what they really got was a wealth of stories. Welcome to Wrexham takes a much broader view than a typical sports docuseries, looking beyond the stadium. It's why some people have called it a real-life Ted Lasso. Yes, there are plenty of episodes about the team to satisfy that competitive itch. Viewers are on the sidelines for Wrexham's euphoric 91st-minute win over rival Stockport in the FA Trophy semifinals. In the upcoming season, they'll share in the outrage as star player Paul Mullen suffers a punctured lung after a collision in a preseason game. Time and again, they're brought inside the locker room as Wrexham manager Phil Parkinson fires F-bombs, tallied on screen as Phil's enthusiasm. But entire episodes center on the working-class town of Wrexham and its fandom. Viewers learn of its former glory as a coal mining center and how the year 1934, embroidered on the nape of players' shirts, is an observance of the Gresford Colliery disaster that killed more than 260 men. They meet third-generation fan Sean Winter, a divorced dad on a sobriety journey who lives to take his sons to weekend matches. There's Wayne Jones, the turf pub owner, who's a reliable voice of hope, and Annette Gardner, a happy clapper, who's content to support the club from which she found solace after her husband died. Then there's the celebrity element, Will Ferrell, Paul Rudd, McElhenney's sunny co-star Glenn Howerton, and Hugh Jackman all make appearances. So do Reynolds and McElhenney's actress wives, Blake Lively and Caitlin Olson. King Charles and the Queen Consort even make a stop at Racecourse Ground Stadium. In an especially memorable season 2 episode, Charlie Day is reduced to tears as Wrexham secures a crucial win against Yeovil. Welcome to football, buddy, McElhenney tells his other sunny co-star. What I believe people care about are stories. They care about the best stories, the stories that get them invested, said McElhenney, age 47. What we're trying to say is the game of football is a conduit into some of the greatest stories that you've ever been told, and that the games are just an extension of that. Your heart will be broken, and you will fall in love, and you will feel joy. You will feel triumph, and you will feel loss. In season one, Wrexham lost, failing to secure promotion after a breakout year. In season two, the Red Dragons won. Fans of the team know how season three ends, but we won't spoil that for fans of the show here. Throughout it all, Reynolds and McElhenney have faced criticism along with acclaim. Some people take exception to Wrexham being portrayed as underdogs, given their Hollywood owners' deep pockets. A New York Times magazine story said their roster is full of what are effectively ringers being paid situationally outlandish amounts from what I can't help imagining are the profits of the Deadpool franchise, end quote. Indeed, in the season when Wrexham secured promotion, it had the fourth highest paid players in the National League. And when the club released its accounts in March, it showed that it was essentially an $11 million loss for Reynolds and McElhenney. But consider Wrexham's ultimate goal of the Premier League and the price tag that comes along with it, and that figure becomes measly. In the top tier, many teams are valued in the billions. Even middling players make millions a year, with exceptional ones like Kevin De Bruyne of Manchester City earning an almost $26 million salary. All criticism when it comes to this stuff is fair game, says Reynolds, age 47. There's no part of me that thinks we're trying to shut it down. We are pushing as hard as humanly possible for this club to get as far as possible in this sport in the least amount of time. Another criticism is that the show's self-awareness is self-serving. The Ringer called it cleverly packaged, binge-worthy propaganda, capitalizing on the fastest-growing sport in the United States. But the owners and their Emmys aren't fazed. McElhenney says almost everything is on the table, with only the most private moments shielded from view. If I see something with me where I'm acting impetuous or I'm embarrassed, I'm like, it's got to go in because it needs to feel real and organic. As much as my ego wants to take it out, I think the audience will smell that, and they will recognize that's false, he says.
Okay, one more article from the Life section. This is a review of a movie, Zendaya's Challenges serves up saucy love triangle. The saucy tennis melodrama Challengers is all about the emotional game we play with each other, though there are certainly enough volleys, balls, and close-up sweat globules if you're more into jock straps and metaphors. Italian director Luca Guadagnino, Call Me By Your Name, puts an art house topspin on the sports movie with fierce competition, even fiercer personalities, and athletic chutzpah set to the thumping beats of a techno riff, Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross score. Challengers, which got 3 out of 4 stars and is rated R and hits theaters on Friday, centers on the love triangle between doubles partners turned rivals Mike Faist and Josh O'Connor, and a teen wonderkind played by Zendaya, and how lust, ambition, and power dynamics evolve their relationships over the course of 13 years. The movie opens with Art and Tashi as the it couple of pro tennis. He's eyeing a U.S. Open title, the only tournament he's never won, while she's his intense coach, manager, and wife, a former sensation along the lines of a Venus or Serena, whose career was cut short by a gnarly knee injury. To build up his flagging confidence after recent losses, Tashi enters Art in a lower-level event that he can dominate until he faces ex-bestie Patrick in the final match. Justin Kuritz's soapy screenplay bounces between the present and the trio's complicated past via flashback, starting when Art and Patrick, a ride-or-die duo known as Fire and Ice, both have eyes for Tashi. All three are 18, and the hormones are humming. The boys have been tight since they were preteens and at boarding school, but a late-night three-way makeout session and the fact she'll only give her number to whoever wins the guy's singles match creates a seismic crack that plays itself out over the coming years. All three main actors ace their arcs and changing looks over time. That's a key non-linear film. That's a key to a nonlinear film like this that's all over the place. As Tashi, Zendaya plays a woman who exudes an unshakable confidence through her passion for these two men is seemingly one weakness. Face, who played in West Side Story, crafts art as a talented precision player whose love for the game might not be what it once was, while O'Connor gives Patrick a charming swagger without a racket, even though his life has turned into a bit of disaster. From the start, the men's closeness hits at something more than friendship, a quasi-sexual tension that Tashi enjoys playing with. She jokes that she doesn't want to be a homewrecker, yet wears a devilish smile when Art and Patrick kiss, knowing the mess she's making. Tennis is a relationship, Tashi informs them, and Guadagnino uses the sport to create moments of argumentative conversation as well as cathartic release. Propelled by thumping electronica, his tennis scenes mix brutality and grace with stylish, super-duper close-ups and even showing the ball's point of view in one dizzying sequence. Could he do the same with, say, curling or golf? It'd be cool to see, because more often than not, you want to get back to the sweaty spectacle. Guadagnino could probably make a whole movie about masculine vulnerability in athletics rather than just tease it with challengers with revealing bits set in a locker room and saunas. But the movie already struggles with narrative momentum given the many tangents in Tashi, Art, and Patrick's thorny connections. While not exactly flabby, the film clocks in at 131 minutes, and the script could use the same toning up as its sinewy performers. While Challenger falls nebulously somewhere between a coming-of-age flick, dysfunctional relationship drama, and snazzy sports extravaganza, Guadagnino nevertheless holds serve with yet another engaging, hot-blooded tale of flawed humans figuring out their feelings. A couple of more articles as we wrap up. Tesla plans to lay off nearly 2,700 in Texas. Texas is planning to lay off nearly 2,700 workers in Austin, Texas, in their factory in June, according to worker adjustment and retraining notification notice obtained by multiple outlets. The layoff notice for 2,688 employees was posted Monday under the WARN Act, a U.S. labor law that requires employers with 100 or more employees to provide 60 days notification in advance of planned closings or mass layoffs to protect workers and their families, Reuters reported. Tesla's notice says layoffs will start coming on June 14th, according to Reuters. The company is currently based in Austin. The layoffs come ahead of the company's earnings call scheduled for Tuesday, where a drop in year-over-year revenue is expected to be announced for the first time since 2020 amid layoffs. There has been price cutting and a fight over the potential $56 billion pay package for CEO Elon Musk. Last week, the company recalled nearly 4,000 Cybertrucks over a defect with the accelerator, causing it to get stuck when pressed, increasing the risk of crash. Missouri Walmart nixes self-checkout lanes. One Walmart in Missouri is ditching self-checkout kiosks, bringing employees back to work with the register. A Walmart store located in Shrewsbury, a suburb of St. Louis, has begun converting the self-checkout lines to traditional checkout lines, Walmart spokesman Breon Little said in a statement to USA Today. The decision was based on several factors, including feedback from associates and customers, shopping patterns, and business needs in the area, Little added. We needed the change. We believe the change will improve the in-store shopping experience and give our associates the chance to provide more personalized and efficient service, the Walmart store also confirmed to USA Today. The kiosks were being removed. Dr. Pepper announces new limited time flavor. This is my last article. Dr. Pepper has a new flavor coming out just in time for summer. The company announced Dr. Pepper Creamy Coconut and Dr. Pepper Creamy Coconut Zero Sugar will be available beginning May 1 at retailers nationwide through the end of July. The flavor will be sold in 12-ounce 12-packs and also 20-ounce bottles, the company said. And this brings together the perfect combination of the original 23 Dr. Pepper flavors with a layer of tropical coconut flavor and a delicious creamy finish, Dr. Pepper says the new flavor pairs perfectly with a summer hot day and is the only coconut cream flavored dark soda on the market. Dr. Pepper also released coconut flavor creamer.
And to round out the hour, Judd advocates for suicide prevention at White House. Ashley Judd is supporting mental health initiatives on behalf of herself and her late mother, Naomi Judd. Nearly 2 years after the country music legend's death by suicide, her daughter Ashley Judd appeared on a panel at the White House on Tuesday in support of the Biden administration's newly formed National Strategy for Suicide Prevention. I'm here because I am my beloved mother's daughter, and on the day she died, which will be the 2-year anniversary in 1 week, the disease of mental illness was lying to her, and with great terror convinced her that it would never get better, the actress said. Naomi Judd died in April 2022 at age 76. The country singer's daughters, Ashley Judd, 56, and Winona Judd, 59, shared the news, saying, "We lost our beautiful mother to the disease of mental illness." Judd said her mother lived most of her life with an untreated and undiagnosed mental illness that lied to her and stole from her. "It stole from our family, and she deserved better," she added. Judd, who is a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, relayed how poor mental health has impacted her in contrast to her mother. "I know the feeling of not wanting to be here, but I had a different experience because I went to treatment in 2006, she shared. "I've been in good recovery for 18 years, and I've had a different outcome than my mother. I carry a message of hope and recovery." And now some other shorts from around the world. California, San Francisco. A few weeks after the San Francisco Zoo announced they were bringing back pandas to the United States, the zoo said they're bringing the cuddly bears to Northern California. The pandas are being brought to San Francisco as part of China's panda diplomacy program, Mayor London Breed's office said. And in Kansas, in Topeka, Karen, a 5-year-old female ostrich at the Topeka Zoo, recently died after grabbing and swallowing a staff member's keys, the zoo announced. And then, keeping to the animal theme, from South Carolina, this from Gaffney, a 71-year-old man's dog proved to be man's best friend when his faithful companion remained by his side after he got tangled in barbed wire and stayed trapped for more than 2 days. And finally, from Oregon, this is Corvallis. A black bear was spotted taking an early morning stroll through the city of Corvallis. The police department said that the Oregon State Police and the Department of Fish and Wildlife were notified about the sightings and were actively monitoring the situation. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Lori Lee,
Tyra Banks,
and Joe Brazel
have been reading from the USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, ncreadingservice.org. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program and at 9:30 for readings from the News and Observer. Up next, health issues.